was learning the recorder, there was a view of technique as being very robotic, or if you play in a technical way, that's a bad thing. I just find that it's an artist's toolbox. So I try to give my students this wonderful artist toolbox they can do absolutely anything with. They understand everything about their instrument, exactly what makes it work. This finger movement, this tongue movement, this way of blowing has this effect, so that they can create any sound they want to. And then it's about getting into the music, understanding the history and the context, understanding where you're performing, what you want to communicate. And then you have all of this knowledge and technique and passion that you can put into a package. And yeah, I think I've just described being a musician, basically.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Sarah Jeffrey is a wonderful and versatile recorder player based in the Netherlands, known worldwide for her outreach with her YouTube project Team Recorder, which at the time of this podcast release has well over 205,000 very engaged followers. She's the recorder professor specializing in contemporary music at the Royal College in London, and we talked about her work teaching recorder technique, improvisation in different styles, her varied career including experimental theater, and her synesthesia, which directly informs her work as a musician. There's lots more to this wide-ranging episode, which features some fantastic recorder performances as well. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. The podcast theme music was commissioned from composer Nick Cold, and you can use the timestamps to navigate the episode. Before we jump into our conversation, I wanted to let you know that I have a new way you can support this independent podcast through a beautiful collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly. You'll find that link in the description of this episode. This weekly podcast is in season 4, and I send out an email newsletter where you can get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including the store for the very cool shirts, mugs, and more, and the support link to buy this independent podcaster a coffee. Now to Sarah Jeffrey. Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me.
I was thinking how you are one of the most important ambassadors for music, really. I mean, you have such incredible reach through Team Recorder, both in community music, and you must bring in people to, you know, because of your free improv and all the different work you do. Maybe, do you think some people are surprised to start following you because they took recorder in school and now they're finding out about all kinds of things?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's a big part of the reason why I do what I do, to bring in people to the recorder and to music and just the love of making music. But yeah, I really try and show all the different facets of what it means to be a musician, of what my instrument can do. And because the recorder is so versatile, so varied, I'm sure that everyone is surprised at some point, myself included.
Well, I've enjoyed so many of your beautiful videos. And I think one of the reasons, so it's been almost 10 years since you've had this channel, Team Recorder. Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, I don't think I've seen your very earliest videos. You have a wonderful presence where you include bloopers. You're very much yourself. Did you always have that persona in your videos?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's important to see the context of where I was coming from in terms of YouTube. Mm-hmm. So my first video I uploaded at the very end of 2015. This was very much in the era of the big famous YouTube names were still filming sitting in their bedrooms, on their beds, using their phones. It was very DIY. Social media today is all professional studio setups. It's completely a different level, a different world. But I came up in a previous era that was very much just kind of figuring it out yourself. And part of that was being very real, very relatable. And now that relatability has almost become a kind of like a selling point almost, or people affect relatability. But it was really just very natural. Yeah. You talk about something, you make a blooper, you leave it in. It's all part of the atmosphere. And I liked that very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was looking, I've actually never had a recorder player on this series, but I was following many recorder players because I do love the recorder, and I was fascinated to learn that so many of you play jazz, do different kinds of improvisation, folk music, rock, like it's really a huge gamut, not just medieval, Renaissance, and Baroque, which most of us associate.
Oh, definitely. I mean, part of it is that the recorder does not have your typical orchestral career path. So opportunities for our instrument going into it are much more scarce than many other classical instruments. So you get recorder players, we tend to be very creative. You have to think outside the box. You have to create your own path because there isn't one for you. And the other thing is that early music is full of improvisation. It's full of playing by ear, constructing your own scores. A lot of these things have parallels in jazz or in pop or in folk. So it just feels very natural that we cross over into all these different genres.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. As a violinist, I found a lot of your videos really very interesting, especially you have one about Renaissance ornamentation, for example.
Right.
As someone who's only played, you know, early Baroque and not, you know, earlier. So I encourage people who aren't recorder players to just dive in. Now, in 2017, you won the International Recorder Competition, and the prize was to mm-hmm. produce an album, which I hope we can talk about Constellations a little bit.
Yes, definitely.
But I'm curious about this competition. What did that look like?
That's the International Nordhorn Competition. It's in Nordhorn in Germany. It's set up by two very dedicated musicians, Sanna von Elst and Bobby Rotfeld. And they've really created an international music community in their small town. I thought, let's enter the competition. I won it. It was, yeah, great.
Did you have to play a range of music from different periods? How did that work?
Oh, yes. I mean, we do always anyway. Yeah. what did I play? Oh, I'll tell you, the thing that attracted me to the competition was that they always have a contemporary music prize with a set work. And that year, the set work was this piece that by chance I had studied. And I can tell you, that was the most difficult, challenging piece I have ever played in my life. It took me a year to study this piece. It was called Liturgy of Darkness 5 by Raphael Reiner. And I looked at it and thought, why is this on the set list? So I was like, well, you know, I poured a year of my life into learning this piece. I'm going to go and play it. So I did. I went and played it, and it was nice. I won the Contemporary Music Prize as well by playing that ridiculously difficult piece. It's a beautiful piece, but it's very, it's very challenging.
Yeah. I'm sure you have collaborations with composers, and you have to advise them on what's possible on the recorder and what's manageable.
Yes. Yeah. So I was encouraged during my education to always say, everything is possible. Mm. Anything is possible. And that is true. But the recorder is a special instrument. It has vulnerabilities. It has its own danger and fragility. So even though everything is possible, there are very many things that work better than others. It definitely has its idiosyncrasies. So a fearless composer will write anything for the recorder, but a very, very good composer will know exactly what works and what finger combinations create certain sound colours, create certain effects.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the prize, you're able to produce your first, your debut album, Constellations, which I bought on your website, and so I will point people, everything will be linked right in the description of this podcast. The sort of the central work is Vermont Counterpoint by Steve Reich. So you got permission to do this on recorder. Do you want to speak about that?
Yeah, so this was a little passion project of mine. I love the piece Vermont Counterpoint. It's originally for flute and electronics. And I really wanted to make a recorder arrangement. So I worked with sound artist Mushfik Jan Muftuolu, and we augmented the piece with electronic sounds. So the original piece is for different flutes, traverse flutes, that has a wider range than the recorder. You can play all of the those notes on the recorder, but then you spend the entire piece up in the third register of the instrument. I just don't think it sounds very nice. So we chose to take the register down so it sounds sonorous, but the low notes that we miss, we use synthesized sounds. You know, it's a piece with a backing track. We made that into this 8-speaker surround sound that moves as you play. So it was a little bit like taking the electronics from the 80s into the 21st century.
Now, I assumed you hadn't performed it live, but is it possible to do live?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I perform it live a lot. It's, I mean, we have our 8-speaker version and we have our stereo version. So basically, I can rock up anywhere and perform it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's so immersive. You know, of course, I listened with headphones.
Yeah, I think 11 layers, 148 samples, something like that. It was mind-bending to record. I was also something like 7 months pregnant. So. So it was a whole experience.
You're about to hear an excerpt from Steve Reich's minimalist masterpiece, Vermont Counterpoint. And you can listen to the whole work on Sarah Jeffrey's album, Constellations, which you'll find linked in the show notes of this podcast. Also on this record, you have your trio, it's Axolot.
Axolot, yeah.
So you have two versions. Oh, Virgo Splendors, you have this trio version. So I thought that might be nice to include some of that. And this trio is important in your life as well.
Yeah, very much. Yes, so Trio Axolot, it's a chamber ensemble I've been playing in since 2012, I think. Two very dear friends of mine, and we're a recorded trio, but we play early music, contemporary music, theatre, improvisation. We've done many different things over the years, and it's just like this wonderful petri dish of being able to experiment with anything we want to.
O Virgo Splendens is a 14th century canon, and Sarah Jeffrey writes in the program notes that canons are perhaps one of the earliest forms of minimalism. There are two versions of this on her album Constellations, and what you're about to hear is the trio version performed by Trio Axolot. This is a short excerpt, and the link to this album is in the description of this podcast. Yeah, and I remember the first time I heard this album, I think I was out in my garden doing some weeding, and then this piece came on, that the Austro with the circular breathing with around the F, and it was just this super spacey wonderful thing. And it's the kind of thing, like, I might not choose to listen to it, but then I was completely immersed, and it's really just, you get into this moment. It's very right. meditative.
It is. I love this piece. It's one of a handful of pieces that can really only be for the recorder. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when we're thinking about virtuosity in contemporary music, it's when you can take a flute piece and play it on recorder, or a violin piece. And sometimes great colleagues of mine have done that, like, hey, look, Fernie Howe on recorder, or Boulez. But this piece, Austro by Giorgio Tede, it was written for only our instrument. You play the F, the lowest note, so you're closing all the holes. And with these tiny finger movements and changes of breath pressure, you hit all of these different harmonics, really constellations. That's where the name of the album came from. And you're circular breathing at the same time, so it can last as long as you want. It's full of repeats. And as the performer, you also become completely immersed in the sound.
Mm-hmm. You're about to hear a short excerpt from Austro by Giorgio Tede on Sarah Jeffries' album Constellations, and you'll find that link in the description of this podcast. Did you know other works by that composer?
A few, yeah. He's written some other solo recorder works. There's also another piece, I think it's called Contrevent or Contretemps. It's similar idea, but for contrabass recorder.
Okay.
But that's a lot more challenging to circular breathe on a contrabass.
Well, that brings me actually to the whole thing about recorder consorts and the, mm-hmm. the family of recorders. Not everyone listening will know about that. Do you want to speak to that briefly?
Sure. So the recorder is, in fact, a family. You have instruments from the 15-centimetre Gartlein to the sub contrabass great bass in B-flat, which is 3 metres tall. As a recorder player, you are expected to be able to play in all of these sizes. And we play in different sizes, in different models, medieval, Renaissance, Baroque, modern, in different tunings and temperaments. So modern pitch, low Baroque pitch, high Renaissance pitch. It just means we have a very long shopping list.
Do you have friends, colleagues in the recorder world who have perfect pitch? Because I would think that would be so difficult for them.
I'm not sure. That would be very difficult. Yeah, I play with a harpist, mm-hmm. a fantastic harpist, Andrea Futz. She has perfect pitch. And yeah, she said if she had to play in 415 or 392, it would be a nightmare. Yeah. So yeah, luckily I don't.
So that actually brings me, I was really interested to learn that you had synesthesia. One of my daughters has it. She's an artist and designer, actually based in the Netherlands as well. And one of my recent podcast guests, I have done this interview, but as we speak, I haven't put it out there, but it'll be released before yours, is mm-hmm. with the conductor Jessica Cottis. So we spoke about her synesthesia in that episode, because it's so interesting to me that people see color and the shapes. And then I'd asked her about the time aspect, the time space, which you have, because I knew my daughter had that, but Jessica hadn't heard about that. But I guess there's all these different variations of perception.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to me, it's very normal. It's as natural as saying, think of an apple and then you can see an apple. But I realize it does inform my music making a lot. I perform a lot from memory. And when I memorize a piece, I actually construct an internal score in my brain, but according to synesthesia. And then it's just useful for remembering things because everything has a color. I'll remember the colors and I'll be able to see dates, times, names, associations. It's only problematic when I remember something wrong or it turns out there's been a mistake, because then I have to repaint my memory. It's just present. I don't know what it's like to not have that.
You do a lot of improvising. I'm curious, as you're improvising, Sarah, there's a certain anticipation of what you're about to play. And do the colors also anticipate a little bit what you're seeing?
Ooh, my synesthesia is quite like baked into the associations of letters, let's say. I believe it's called like color grapheme synesthesia. I think through music education, you know, I know that this fingering is a B flat, for example. So if I'm playing this, everything is blue. But then if I take a different recorder, I'm playing that same fingering and everything is yellow because I know that that's an E flat. So it's more that sometimes it gets in the way. If I'm playing and I'm existing in one color and then I remember I'm actually on a different instrument, I won't be able to see my way. It's like being lost in the dark. That's a good question. I haven't really thought about it, but I hope my answer kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and I think people won't realize about the, you know, the transposing instruments and how you do have to have these different finger patterns. I don't know how you manage.
Yeah. I always say it's like having different languages. In the beginning, when you learn a new language, you're constantly translating, and eventually you can just speak it fluently. I mean, for recorder players, we have to play as professionals. I have four different keys, like finger systems. We play in C, F, G, and D, then treble and bass clef. So it just gets easier as you go along. And then if I'm picking up, I have a new recorder in B flat over here. So this is a tuning that I've never... Yeah, it's great. I've not played in that tuning before, but you can think, oh, imagine if that I'm playing on a soprano in bass clef and then I add three flats and I'm there. So you find all these shortcuts.
So in terms of the different sizes of recorders, you have a beautiful video I was hoping we could include of Bach, the saraband from the, which suite is it? On bass recorder with Michaela Petri's ornaments.
Yes, the first suite, the G major. Yes, that piece honestly got me through the COVID lockdowns. Michaela Petri, phenomenal recorder legend, publishes music. And she's been arranging one by one the Bach cello suites for recorder with her own ornaments. And at the time the first suite was available, I downloaded it, the sheet music, and have played it nearly every day ever since. And it's just been like a balm for my soul. I've been experimenting a lot with which instruments to use for different movements. And the saraband, it just sounds beautiful on the bass recorder. I love it.
It's so beautiful. Thank you for that. This is Sarah Jeffries' performance of the Saraband from J.S. Bach's Cello Suite in G on bass recorder with ornamentation by Michaela Petri. This performance was recorded at Splendor Amsterdam in the summer of 2021, and the video on the Team Recorder YouTube is in the description of this podcast. Thank you. You mentioned you were 7 months pregnant when you recorded Constellations.
Yes.
I do speak to a few parents on this series, and I have a couple of kids who are now grown up. And what I find interesting as musicians, professional musicians, is how to navigate arts education for our kids.
Right. Yeah.
Well, is it something that you discuss with your partner? Is it, you know, do we push? Do we expose them to a broad range of things? You know what I mean?
That is such a good question. And that's exciting to talk about. So aside from being a parent, I think that arts education, music education, is one of the most essential things in society. I firmly believe that if we had really excellent music education throughout school, if it was well funded and well supported, society would be much better as a result. It promotes listening, communication, teamwork, empathy, creativity, motivation, problem solving. And I think it's in terms of education, it's a tragedy how much music and the arts has been cut. I'm speaking from the Netherlands, from England, I think in the US as well. So as a parent, I think instilling the joy of music in my child is one of the most important things that I can give her. I really, really hope my daughter grows up loving music, but that will be on her own terms. And I see that if she ends up wanting to go into music, I will have the knowledge to help guide her, but I'm not going to put any pressure, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So at home, our home life is infused with music. We are always listening to music. We have a house full of instruments. We play together all the time. We take her to see concerts. Her life is full of music, and we want music to feel like home. We want it to be full of joy. We want it to always be there if she needs it, but not a source of pressure or panic or stress. Mm-hmm. It's also for my students. If my child or my friends or my students end up being fantastic touring concert musicians, wonderful. If they say, you know what, I just love playing and that's enough for me, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. I wanted to let you know that I have a new way you can support this independent podcast through a beautiful collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly. You'll find that link in the description of the episode. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media and share my posts, and if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing. You'll find that link in the show notes along with the merch store. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode. So through Team Recorder, you must have made some very interesting connections also with the amateur communities.
Yes, yes, definitely. So I've been lucky to kind of come into contact with this incredible global community of recorder players. I had no idea existed. And I think a lot of people didn't know that none of us had any idea there were other recorder players out there. So in one of my early videos, I made a joke to the camera like, oh, I've got 400 subscribers now. Well, I guess that's all of us. And in the meantime, there's recorder players everywhere. And this is also down to the incredible teachers in all of these locations. Everywhere where there's a great recorder community, it will be because of a local teacher who is pouring their heart and soul into making that happen. So I think the internet has just allowed us to come into contact with one another. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful video you put out where you were calling to task these broadcasters for sort of making fun of recorder education they got and not appreciating it.
Absolutely. I mean, I just call it lazy journalism. And I understand you, as a human being, you can't know everything about everything, right? But the recorder becomes the butt of a joke. I think that's just such a shame. I also used to joke that if a journalist interviews me and doesn't say, oh, well, the recorder we know from primary school, then I would pay them £1 million. Luckily, journalism has come on a little bit since then, so I've been asked some more sensible questions. I think the reason it bothers me when journalists and the media makes fun of recorder isn't for the recorder itself. I don't mind a joke. I don't mind people lightheartedly, you know, taking the piss a bit. It's because arts and culture and music education has been eviscerated. We are in an educational culture where music is not valued, it's not funded, we're not given the resources or the training or the funding or the expertise that it needs. So within that climate, to then put it down feels really terrible. If we were lucky enough to be in a climate where we had all of the support from the government to the local level for music, I would be much more able to take a joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of people never hear professional recorder playing. They don't know. They only hear beginners. So that's our association.
Yeah, exactly. And that is why I started Team Recorder. Mm-hmm. I thought, why do people think the recorder is a beginner's instrument? Because we never hear it. In 2015, I was looking on YouTube. I was looking on the internet for information about the recorder, even just performance videos. And back then, there was nothing, nothing. And I thought, well, of course people underestimate the recorder. There's no information about it. And how did I get all the information I know? I went to conservatoire for 9 years. I came up in a time where it was very affordable to study. I could move to a country in order to do that. I could move from the UK to the Netherlands. That is not accessible for most people. So in order to change people's minds about that instrument, that information has to be made available. And I think it's accessibility of information, I think, is so important.
Mm-hmm. And it is really the best thing about the internet.
Absolutely. Yeah. Information and community.
Yeah. Now, in terms of your mentors, Annabelle Knights was one of your...
That's right. Yes. So I studied my bachelor's at the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire in the UK. Annabelle Knight and Ross Winters were my teachers there. Ross Winters has sadly passed away recently. Annabelle is incredibly active in the UK, especially for young players up to up to conservatoire level. She is doing really, really fantastic work.
So when you entered, you hadn't had a private recorder lesson?
Not really, no. So I started recorder when I was 6. My mum is an amateur recorder player. She started a group at my primary school.
Okay.
But I did not like having my mum teach me. So I told her to go away. Sorry, mum. And I just taught myself from a book. Then from the age of 8, my local music centre, Derby Music Centre, had a Saturday morning music school and they had a recorder club. So I went to that every Saturday.
Okay.
Throughout my childhood. So that was how I learned, in an ensemble. So by the time I'd gone through that, it meant that I had some skills. My sight reading was very good. My rhythm is very good. I had no technique, no articulation, no breathing skills, because I never really played on my own before. And throughout childhood, I did have lessons on piano and flute.
Okay.
So that was how I got my music education. But there was never any view to doing it professionally. It was just for fun. And when I was 17, I was planning to go to university, study medicine and become a doctor. Very sensible. And I, in my last couple of years at high school, I got a wonderful, wonderful music teacher, school music teacher. I was singing A-level music. Miss Jackson. We're still in contact now, if she's listening. And she encouraged me. She was wonderful. I mean, I cannot praise high school music teachers enough. So Miss Jackson gave me all the encouragement. We also had a second music teacher, Mrs. Morse, who was who is a recorder enthusiast. She kept bringing me music, and the two of them kind of picked me up and guided me through my grade 8, which is the exam you need to kind of audition for music college. So with their encouragement, I thought, all right, I've no idea what I'm doing, but maybe I can do this. And I auditioned, and they let me in.
You auditioned on recorder or piano?
A recorder. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I love piano. There's not a chance in a billion that I would be able to study piano. It's just not where my heart is. I mean, I really like playing at home. I would not want to be a concert pianist. Absolutely not. Recorder is from the... It's captivated me. There's nothing else I want to do. And still, after all this time, I still have the same love and passion for it.
It's wonderful to hear. And another one of your mentors was Jorge...
Jorge Isaac, okay. Yeah.
Jorge Isaac.
Yes.
So in the Netherlands?
That's right. So after I graduated from Birmingham, I thought, oh, well, I'll move to Amsterdam and do a year of study. 17 years later, I'm still here. But my teacher at the Conservatorium of Amsterdam was Jorge Isaac. He is a real specialist in contemporary music. And he was very inspiring for me in terms of not only contemporary music, but music theatre, improvisation, electronics, just kind of really daring to experiment.
Mm-hmm. And your Dutch is pretty good. Like, you actually do some translation?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I speak fluent Dutch. Yeah, I love languages, and I started learning from the second I got there. So I always try to, you know, just learn it.
That's good to hear. I mean, many expats have told me they found it hard because Dutch people tend to speak English back, or it was hard to practice their Dutch.
Yeah, I mean, with Dutch, the first years, you definitely know that everyone's English is better than your Dutch. I did lots of babysitting.
Okay.
I worked with kids. I taught teenagers for many years. I mean, nothing improves your Dutch like a class of 13-year-olds looking at you when you've made a grammatical mistake and they're like, why did you say that? And then, you know, they're not afraid to correct you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. And do you also know German or some other European languages?
I can fake German. So we had French and German in school to a very basic level. When I'm in German, I can chat with people after a concert because I know all the musical words. And I've studied a little bit of Portuguese. No, I mean, Dutch is the only language that I really speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love languages, and I like to talk to people about learning them and strategies. So I guess you were immersed and you went for it, basically.
Yeah. I managed to stay ahead of the curve. So I started with an intense language program. So I started practicing right away. And people would say, oh, you've only been here a week. You sound great. And I managed to just stay ahead of that wave. So wherever I was, they said, oh, you've been here 2 months. You sound great. And I did get a job in a cafe.
Okay.
So, and I just told them I spoke Dutch. I didn't. Just had to learn.
Well, that kind of bravery certainly comes across in your creativity. I was interested in your free improvisation, and you teach as well. I think it's at Sound Lab in Amsterdam.
That's right, yeah. So I taught at the Sound Lab in the Muziekgebouw Natuur in Amsterdam. I taught there from 2011 to 22. And there is a kind of laboratory of about 60 instruments most of which only exist there. They were developed with local sound artists. And the idea is that we take a group, either a school class, it can be for any age really, adults as well, and we have a 90-minute workshop on composition, improvisation, conducting, except we don't use those big scary words. We guide through all kinds of group activities. And in the end, we've created our own composition that can be performed, that can be practiced, that's really, really something solid that we've all made together. And you can do this with no prior experience at all. And it's just wonderful. I mean, it's so much fun to do, and it taught me so much as a musician as well.
Did you find with groups of adults that this sense of play was kind of new for them?
Yes, absolutely. We did a lot of, for example, team building workshops for companies. Adults find it a lot more difficult to get into than kids. But every target group has their own special thing, mm-hmm. basically. We did do some workshops with conservatorium students, for example. These are students on the verge of being professional musicians. They found it extremely difficult to let go and not overthink and plan everything. My favourite age group to work with is group 5 in the Netherlands, like 9-year-olds. I guess that's like third grade, because they just have all of this imagination and fantasy and no self-consciousness, and they would come out with incredible compositions.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the favourite instruments you got to play as part of that sound lab?
There's an instrument called the tone pad. That means tone pad. And it was developed for people with limb differences. So you can play it if you don't have hands, for example, or if you don't have full mobility. And it's like an upturned wooden bowl. And it's has warmth heat sensors. Mm-hmm. So wherever you touch it, it makes different chords. And you can use your forearm, you can use your chin, and it comes out with these beautiful chords and it lights up at the same time.
Beautiful. Any other memorable instruments there?
Yes, there's also like a sequencer synthesizer called the Datto, named after its two makers called Daniel and Tone. And it's just a really user-friendly sequencer. So you push different buttons, it goes and you can play with all these parameters. But the interface, how it looks, is really... it's really very simple, so we can have kids using it. It's very addictive to play with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in your trio Axolot and also Jerboa, you do a certain amount of free improvisation. And
yeah.
There was one, I think it was with Jerboa, where it was based on the Alexander technique.
So Jerboa is the kind of prog jazz rock quartet I play in. We all write our own songs. Our drummer Marcos Baggiani does a lot of Alexander technique, and his teacher was always saying to him, allow your neck to be free, allow your neck to be free. So we have one song where those are the lyrics and we're all singing it together, and we take every opportunity really to improvise together. That song has a long intro with me and Marcos playing together. Yeah, but we're happy to put in some improvisation to any song.
It's quite a unique band.
It's, you know, it's funny, we hear that all the time. Wherever we play, people love it. But they say, it's so unique, I've not heard anything before. And we're all, you know, we'll take the compliment, but slightly flummoxed, because we just put together the music that makes sense to us. So we're four musicians, we come from different backgrounds, we come from different countries, and we've put together our favourite music, and this is the result. So for us, it's the most self-explanatory thing in the world. And it's always really interesting to hear people's reactions.
For this podcast, Sarah has shared a track from Jerboa's upcoming album that will be released very soon. This is called Walking, and it is written by Marcos Baggiani, who is the drummer of Jerboa. And she wrote to me, "It starts quiet, but really builds up towards the end. Enjoy."
Del alma la tierra que nos hizo, jirones de cielo cantando en tu rostro, flores abriendo en tu mirada, tierra que nos ama, tierra que nos da, derrumban la puerta, venimos a hablar, el cielo se derrite, llora el hielo que se va, el sol brillando en las aguas, reflejo en tu piel, cubriendo el mar, en tu reino madre, todo bajo agua quedará. La la la.
No, I had asked about the Alexander technique because I was curious if you'd studied it, because you might.
Ah, yeah, I haven't myself, but
your neck's already free.
Markle's has. Yeah.
Okay. So Sarah, you've done quite a bit of music for like music theater for children, for young mm-hmm. children. Do you want to speak to some of those projects?
Yes, with my theatre company, Theatre Floop, we make music theatre for very young children, age 2 to 4. And the great thing about that age group is, one, they're very, very open and curious, and the other is that the target audience refreshes itself every 2 years. So that's very handy. But with music and with dance, we made this beautiful show called Erdlogere, that means sleepover, about the first time you sleep away from home. Another example of a very nice piece I worked on that was with my trio Axolot was with Het Zuidelijk Toneel in the Netherlands, the Theatre of the South, and it was called Hoe de grote mensen weggingen en wat er daarna gebeurde, which means When the Grown-Ups Left Us and What Happened After That. It was a show 2 hours long without a break for children aged 8, and the premise was it was a story about a village where all the grown-ups suddenly stop loving their children and they leave. All of the music that we played live was by Obrecht, this medieval composer. So all of these elements sound bizarre. Halfway through the show, all of the actors leave and we're just left alone on the stage. And the children in the audience each have a little bag with headphones in, and they start buzzing. And 10 of the children from the audience put the headphones on and they come on stage, and they're guided by the actors who are backstage. And for the rest of the show, the children from the audience play the rest of the performance.
Wow.
It was incredible. So every show, we'd have 10 new kids who had no idea they were going to be on stage performing in big theatres. And I can tell you, it worked. The director is Jetsa Batalan. He has this incredible mind. And it was funny. It was beautiful. It was affecting. It was very, very special. And to be a part of something like that, it was an experience I'll never forget.
It gives me goose pimples thinking about it, but I have to ask, did the adults don't come back at the end of the plot?
They do.
Okay.
So, spoiler, at the very, very end, so the kids on stage, it takes a long time, they come up, they put on the costumes, they do all different things together. At one point they find these bags of chips, so they all have a snack. Then they're allowed to completely ruin the stage. They run around with a fire extinguisher. The climax is that this giant wooden house on the stage falls apart. At the very end of the show, the parents do come back and they're all like dirty and decrepit and like holding their arms out for the children, and the children just look at them and silently leave the stage because they gain their independence. So they do come back in the end.
So how do the children in the audience react when just a few of them are you know, have this opportunity to go on stage?
It's given a lot of time. So the whole transition from the actors leaving the stage to the first child standing up and entering the stage is about 15 minutes. And when you're sitting in a silent theatre, that's a long time. But it's all done with lighting. We had this incredible scenography from Tone Mosque and lighting. So we gradually get the dawn. And the most important thing is that the whole making process of this theatre production took months with experts. So we have the actors, we have the director, we had a whole team of pedagogical experts, and we had test audiences from local schools to try out what worked and what didn't. Okay. So they have, the kids have these headphones and they have very clear instructions, and there's lots of safety nets. So quite often we'd have a kid that didn't want to do it, and that's fine, and then they're taken this way and they are brought back to their seat. And yeah, so it's this experimental children's theatre in the Netherlands is really special. It's they really dare to go places you wouldn't expect working.
Being a British person, do you find the culture is very different that way in general?
I do. In the Netherlands, it's... So in the UK, we have a huge amount of rules, regulations, red tape. A lot of it is there to keep us safe and to keep things working. A lot of it just doesn't exist in the Netherlands. So there's a bit more freedom to work. I think here in the Netherlands, it's a lot more relaxed. I mean, I would go and see with my students or with the kids I babysit for, go and see movies, kids' movies that had been banned in the US because they depicted someone smoking or they depicted a kid riding their bike without a helmet. And in the Netherlands, people are just like, what are you, like, come on, it's fine. Certain things are much more relaxed here.
And the arts funding is different, do you find?
So the arts funding in the Netherlands has historically been much, much better. That was one of the things that attracted me to moving here was the fantastic arts culture. Over the past decade, it has been completely decimated. We have had a government who have been openly hostile towards the arts and funding. We've had a minister, we've had ministers saying things like, why do we need the theatre? You can just watch a DVD. They've stamped the arts as a leftist hobby. We've now had an ultra right wing government voted in who unanimously agree that they want to just cut the arts. So it's looking very bleak at the moment. And the Netherlands has this wonderful music culture. They have incredible musicians, incredible concert halls, but that is all going to wither away if we don't have support, both for professionals and for education. So it's very, very, very sad.
Yeah. And you teach in London still?
I do. So I am a professor of recorder at the Royal College of Music. I was appointed in 2022. So yes, I teach there. It's wonderful. It's my dream job. So I'm very, very happy to be there.
And aren't you the contemporary music specialist for recorder there?
Yes. So the recorder department has three professors. We're each a specialist, one for Baroque, one for Renaissance, and myself for contemporary. We all take chamber music. That's one very nice thing in the college. Actually, any professor can give chamber music coaching to any ensemble. So I can teach non-recorder players too. This past year, I've been working with the composition department to create new works for recorder. And we've been working with the museum from the historical performance faculty, reconstructing original instruments.
Yes, I saw your video about the 3D printed.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It means that our students can really touch history and get to grips with it. So, yeah.
Do you want to speak to that project a little bit?
Yes. So at the Royal College of Music, there's currently a research project in collaboration with the University of Turin. At the Royal College, they have original 18th century instruments in their museum, including three original ivory recorders. Sorry, two ivory, one wooden. They have a cornetto, chalumeaus, I believe traversos, maybe. But these instruments have been scanned at the Natural History Museum, so that we can really get their measurements, we can see exactly what condition they're in. And they're in the process of being 3D printed to a very, very detailed degree. So this is different from your 3D printing at home. It's really within a university lab setting. And there's lots of research experimentation going into the materials, the density. And one very exciting thing is the original instruments are quite damaged due to the passage of time. There are cracks, there is warping, just because these instruments are hundreds of years old. So the 3D printer versions, we can print exact replicas and digitally repaired replicas. That means our students can experience firsthand, what does it mean if your instrument's warped? Okay, there's a crack here, what does it do to the sound? That means they can really understand the instruments so much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how does your commute work then, living in Amsterdam?
I can go once a month.
Okay.
Like a lot of conservatoires, they say, we expect our professors to have an international character. That means, you know, we come from all over. I visit once a month and do my lessons in a block. And because they have their other two professors, they can also do the same. So the students can enjoy regular lessons and we can work a little bit in that way.
Mm-hmm. That's really mm-hmm. great. And you've also done some studio work. I believe you recorded for Bob's Burgers, which is such a fun show.
Yes. Oh, that was great. That was a very happy day I got that email. Yeah, I've been very lucky to get in contact with some great people due to being on the internet. I recorded on the soundtrack of Bob's Burgers last year. They had a wonderful episode called Amelia that featured one of the kids playing a bass recorder, and they wanted real bass recorder on the soundtrack. The team are wonderful. When I did the recording, it was with the entire team there, the composer, the crew, the director, and we spent a lot of time experimenting, using different instruments, creating layers of sound. So that was wonderful to see how they not only have an idea for their show, but they really support it with the music as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it might be interesting to talk about your teaching. You're teaching at a very high level at the Royal Academy in terms of mm-hmm. teaching your students to take expressive risks.
Right. I always tell my students that mistakes are useful data. So I don't want them necessarily to come to their lessons and have everything CD perfect, but they're terrified. I would rather dig into the music and really find their own way of playing it. And if you have to take a risk and make a mistake, great, that has to happen. I also teach technique, and technique, instrumental technique, is something I'm very, very interested in, very passionate about. And I feel that when I was learning the recorder, there was a view of technique as being very robotic, or if you play in a technical way, that's a bad thing. I just find that it's an artist's toolbox. So I try to give my students this wonderful artist's toolbox they can do absolutely anything with. They understand everything about their instrument, exactly what makes it work. This finger movement, this tongue movement, this way of blowing has this effect, so that they can create any sound they want to. And then it's about getting into the music, understanding the history and the context, understanding where you're performing, what you want to communicate, and then you have all of this knowledge and technique and passion that you can put into a package. And yeah, I think I've just described being a musician basically. But none of that comes without expectation of falling over and picking yourself up again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for your channel, are people always throwing requests at you, or is it generated mostly from your own, what you want to bring it out?
A bit of both. I definitely get a lot of requests. In the beginning, I was leaning heavily into recorder technique, because again, that's what I like talking mm-hmm. about. I had a lot of kind of ideas with that. You know, now I'm nearly 400 videos in. Sometimes I say to the audience, like, okay, what do you want to hear? And someone might just have this spark of an idea that I say, okay, great, I'll film that tomorrow. With centuries of musical history, with all the different pieces in our repertoire, instruments, there's almost an infinite number of videos that I can make. So the ideas don't run out.
In terms of the Renaissance repertoire, is a lot of it hasn't been recorded, I'm guessing?
Well, that's the thing. There's not original Renaissance recorder repertoire doesn't really exist, because we tend to adapt music from other instruments, mm-hmm. vocal music, even keyboard music, viol music. So it's more of a case that maybe it hasn't been adapted yet.
So, but the recorder, excuse my ignorance. So I thought people were playing the recorder in medieval and Renaissance times, but you're saying there wasn't that much written for it till the Baroque.
Music publication worked in a different way. So when the first music was being published, we see a lot of, for example, sonatas or canzonas published for recorder or flute or oboe or violin or cornetto. It wouldn't always be specifically for one instrument. You know, they've also got to make a living from their printing press. And we know that recorder-like instruments have existed for 40,000 years. We have bone flutes existing from 38,000 years ago. But not all of the music would have been written down. It wouldn't necessarily have survived. So it's much more of a recent thing that it says, for sopranino recorder in G at 415, the instrumentation of a piece was much broader.
Okay. No, I was thinking, I interviewed Elizabeth Pallett, who's a British lutenist, and she's really a Renaissance specialist, and she was saying there's, of course, all this tablature that just people are just discovering it, and it hasn't been recorded, so she wants to get the music out there, but it's, I guess, different.
Oh, absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So where do you see Team Recorder going in the future?
That's a good question. I would love to, in any case, preserve all of the information on there as a database, as an archive. Now I have these hundreds of videos on YouTube. I would love to have them in a format that's more searchable, more accessible, because I want this information to stay available. Something else that I did during the lockdowns was offer online courses, and they were incredibly successful. So much fun to give. I had a lot of very happy students, but that was also a full-time job. That was great during Corona, because then I could keep working. But something I'm currently working on is creating downloadable courses that people can follow. So a kind of bridging the gap between watching a YouTube video and going for a weekly lesson. Something that can kind of fall there in the middle. One thing I have to be mindful of is we don't know where technology will go. We don't know where social media will go. I think it's already amazing that I've been on YouTube for 8.5 years and it's still, the platform still exists. So you always have to stay flexible, preserving the information as an archive and courses. And the final thing that I'm working very much on is publishing sheet music. So I have 3 books out now with Schott Publishing. I have them all here, so you can see this is my first book. It was released last year. We have 3 books out. I'm working on the 4th as we speak. I'm also writing the recorder method for Hal Leonard. So that's currently, the manuscript is in, we're editing it. So hopefully a lot more sheet music publications will be coming out in the future.
That's exciting. I didn't know about the Hal Leonard project. That must have been so much work.
Yeah. I think I submitted like 138 pieces. Composed a lot of new music. It's great. Yeah, it's still very much in progress, but it's been a wonderful organisation to work with.
Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was a great opportunity, Sarah.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. You'll find that link in the show notes along with the merch store. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. Have a wonderful week.